The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, we've made it to the last item in our list of five Dharma resources for meeting life well. We've talked about confidence, sata, ethical conduct or virtue, sila, listening and learning, sutta, and generosity and letting go, chaga. And then the last item can be seen as something distinct, but it's also one that emerges from and sums up the other four. And it is discernment, panya. That word is also translated as wisdom, but we'll lean toward using discernment for today. And there are many things that it's useful to discern on the path to freedom. The most fundamental is understanding what is unskillful and what is skillful. So discerning between what leads toward suffering and what leads away from suffering. So this links panya to sila, virtue or ethics, but it also goes outside the conventional range of ethics into areas like choosing how to navigate the mind during sitting meditation. Sometimes people think that there shouldn't be any form of judgment in practice. We just accept everything all the time in a passive way. But this is too broad brush. Judiciousness is essential for waking up. This is from the Dhammapada in a chapter called The Just. The wise person who, as if holding a set of scales, selects what's good and avoids what's evil, is for that reason a sage. Whoever can weigh these two sides of the world is for that reason called a sage. So I apologize for the word evil. That's what the translation said. We could just think unskillful or unwholesome. And the same chapter also says, one is not just who judges a case hastily. A wise person considers both what is and isn't right. So these quotes affirm that wise judgment is indeed part of practice. But they also imply, the way these ones were written, having some kind of time to consider options, you know, weighing the two sides of the world, considering both what is and isn't right. And sometimes we have the space to do that, and we should when we can. This is part of living a conscious, reflective life. But there's also what happens in the moment. So fortunately, there are other ways that we can train our discernment so that it becomes a reliable resource, even right in the moment, when it's combined with mindfulness. So to do this, I think it's best to understand the ways in which we tend to make mistakes in how we see things, and then we can train to see in wiser ways. So these are various ways that we don't properly discern what's going on, you know, when we're making mistakes, basically because we gloss over details or we focus on the wrong thing. So the Buddha identified three main mistakes, let's say, to watch for. I think he called them distortions. So one gloss that we make is to see things that are impermanent as permanent, or things that are changing as unchanging. And in many cases, this comes down to a matter of careful mindfulness. So, you know, suppose we're outside and we look across a clearing and we see a black line across the ground. It looks solid, but as we get closer, we see that it's actually a line of ants. It's lots of ants walking close together in the same direction. You can see this sometimes like on retreats, out in retreat centers that are in the jungle or out away from, you know, from the cities. I've seen several of these ant lines. So as we get close, this solid line breaks up into individual ants in motion. Or maybe you've seen those fire sticks that people sometimes wave around on holidays, maybe more often in Asia than here. But you do it at night, and it's a stick that's burning on one end, or these days it might be an LED or something. And it's twirled rapidly in a circle, and it looks like a solid circle of light because we don't see that it's a single light being moved when it's going fast like that. There are many things that are like this. You know, we look out and we see a tree, but if we get closer and closer and closer, like really close, eventually you'll be looking at molecules that are all in motion. You know, how solid is that tree? Sitting in meditation, we might perceive pain in our shoulder to be a solid wall. It feels like a hardened area, almost like a stone. But with careful mindfulness, if we're willing to turn toward it, sometimes the pain can break up into many little sparks of sensation, often in quite a small area. I mean, it might still be there, a strong sensation, but we can't quite believe in its solidity anymore if we look with careful mindfulness. So experiences like solidity and unchangingness are actually products of how we're seeing. If things are changing slowly, or if mindfulness is not very precise, we're just catching a moment here and there, not every moment, then they can seem relatively permanent. It's a very important Dharma insight to see into the impermanent, inconstant, and changing nature of actually all experience. And this greatly assists in letting go, because we discern in sort of at an intuitive level that there really isn't much to grasp. And we can train the mind to discern in this way. You know, we can incline towards seeing in that way. And as we do that, you know, just throughout the day and in meditation, that way of seeing will be available to us as a Dharma resource at moments where it's useful. So then a second gloss or misperception is to see what is ultimately unsatisfying as fully satisfying. So we typically carry the idea that getting something pleasant, something that we want, is going to satisfy us. Maybe it's even going to be the thing that really does it for us. You know, if I just get this one thing, or if I just get rid of this one thing, then it will be better. You know, for example, we might think, I'm going to take a hot bath tonight. That is really going to do it for me after a long day of work. And if the conditions come together and we do get to do that, we enjoy it. But does it really satisfy completely? Doesn't your mind just go on to the next thing that will be just perfect? So we're talking here about this quality of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness in human life. And it helps very much to understand that dukkha doesn't have to have this narrow meaning of suffering, which is often how it's translated. Definitely a nice hot bath is not suffering, nor is it wrong to enjoy it. But a hot bath is dukkha because it is not able to ultimately satisfy us. And if we don't know that, we're actually setting ourselves up for genuine suffering. And if we're honest, really, all those special pleasant things that we create in our life are quite temporary, and sometimes not even as good in the moment as we think they're going to be. Yes, the hot water is nice, but sitting in a bathtub, I find to be a little hard on my back, resting on a hard enamel surface. And after 10 minutes, anyway, the water's cooling off a little bit. So there's an image given in the suttas for the hindrance of sensual desire, which is dyed water, like water that's been dyed a certain color so we don't see very clearly through it. I think it's in sort of an early version of rose-colored lenses. So it's helpful to train our mind to discern when we're looking with rose-colored lenses and not allow ourselves to think that things are going to be more satisfying than they are. Now, definitely sometimes people resist this idea of training the mind to understand that a given experience cannot be ultimately satisfying, but I see it as actually very supportive. In fact, the very fact that we have a distorted perception that some experience is going to make us fully happy, it actually diminishes the enjoyment of it because it places kind of pressure on it in a sense. And when we actually understand that no experience can inherently make us happy, it actually makes it much easier to enjoy things fully and then to let them go as they're passing. So, you know, it's really just a protection for the mind. Don't worry, life is still has many good things, but we're just not distorted about them. Okay, and then the third main gloss, let's say, or non-discerning way of seeing things is to mistake what is not self for an abiding self. And in this case, I haven't found very much value in really thinking about this cognitively. It's really much better just to do as a practice. A great practice that can be done in daily life as well as on the cushion is found in the instructions that the Buddha gave to Bahiya. And I think some of you are likely familiar with them. He said, in the seen, let there just be the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the sensed, just the sensed. And in the cognized, just the cognized. So we practice seeing experience in kind of an unadorned way, a simple way. You know, for example, the sound of a bell. Just ring a bell. I guess I could do that. That one. It's easier. Okay. Listen to this. So it's a simple experience of sound just arising and passing. It doesn't have much to do with our self unless we add one on. But really, it's just the sound coming and going. So in cases like this that are simple, we get a glimpse of the way putting a self onto something, it would be actually imputed onto experience by the mind. If we were to say, that's my sound, that's a special bell just for me, you know, things like that, it's obviously something extra. And that's not to problematize that we do that sometimes. It's just to be accurate that, you know, putting a self on is something extra. It's additional to bare experience. See for yourself. It takes careful mindfulness, but you can see this for yourself. In the words of Joseph Goldstein, only six things ever happen: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mental activity. So the Buddha concludes his teaching to Bahiya by saying, this, just this, is the end of dukkha. So we can see when we can see experience in a simple way, then there isn't suffering or stress. So essentially, when we train not to be fooled into these non-discerning ways of seeing, then we're much more likely to make good decisions in the moment. So non-discernment is to think that things are, in the words of Ruth King, I love the way she puts this, we think that things are permanent, perfect, and personal. And what we want to train in is to not be fooled by that. So if we see more wisely, more discerningly, then we won't be foolishly trying to hold on to or control things that are bound to change. We won't be setting ourselves up for disappointment and dukkha by tying our happiness to things that change and are limited. And we won't be getting wrapped up in thinking that things are inherently personal, inherently ourself, and all the dukkha that goes with that. So this is kind of a culmination of all the things that we've been practicing up to now, the confidence, the sila, the ethics, the learning of the teachings and listening carefully to our experience and then being willing to let go, whether in the form of actually giving something or the releases that happen along the path. You know, then we come to have this discerning view of understanding the changing nature of things and how to live well in the world. And as a reminder, the Buddha said that these five qualities are a form of inner wealth. They're a form of fortitude, of character. They're inspirations. When we think of how they can be known in the world, we feel happy. And people who possess them and have them well at hand are said to be spiritually mature. One that I didn't say up to now is that these are also said to help us at the time of death. And when these are well established in the heart, they assure an easeful death. So these serve us both on and off the cushion to meet life well in the moment. And we can strengthen any and all of them through training, which is very worthwhile to do. And all of them are made potent by mindfulness practice. That's the core foundation behind all of them. So thank you for being here for this week. I very much hope that something in it landed for you and that it will support you and all those around you to take it into your practice in life. Be well.